Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Lucy Pony.
And I'm Michael Atit.
And I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, April 17, 2015.
South Sudanese say forgiveness is the only hope for peace in the country.
Forgiveness doesn't mean justice. So when you forgive somebody, don't say that justice is already finished. No, it's not.
And health officials say Juba Teaching Hospital is seeing more and more patients suffering from mental illness.
We are talking here about trauma and substance of abuse, alcohol and cannabis mainly. They are the main causes of presentation here. Plus the trauma of a long-lasting war, plus the crisis of 2013.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus.
We go first to Khartoum for updates on the Sudanese elections. Vote counting of Sudan's April 13th presidential and parliamentary elections is expected to start today. National Electoral Commission Chair Professor Mokhtar Alassam says the results will be announced immediately at each polling station. He says it is unlikely that there will be a second round because President Omar al-Bashir is very popular among Sudanese. Alassam spoke from Khartoum with VOA's James Batty.
It went without problems. All the polling stations were closed by 7 p.m. tonight. Tomorrow morning, Friday, we'll start counting, and the results will be announced immediately in each polling state. The total results are going to be collected and announced on the 27th of April.
There was a report, Professor, that the election itself was poorly attended.
Well, you can't say this now until we count the number or the percentage of voters to registration. And, of course, you know that the percentage of polling to registration to polling is around 45 and 50%. We expect to be near that figure.
There was a report of an attack on some polling areas in South Kordofan. What can you tell us on that, Professor?
In South Kordofan, the polling stations, all of them were without problem. Yes, there were attacks on the capital of Southern Kordofan, Kadugli, and another town at Diling, and there were casualties. One woman and a child were killed by the missile sent from over the town. But polling stations were not affected.
You know, the opposition did not take part. Can you say, therefore, Professor, that this election was free and fair?
Oh, yes, quite fair, because right now, in this very moment, all the representatives of those who are participating in the elections are present and waiting tomorrow morning for the counting of the votes.
Everybody is assuming that President Omar al-Bashir is going to win, but what happens if nobody gets the majority?
If nobody gets 50% of the votes, we are going to run a second round between those two who got the majority of votes. But it is very unlikely because it seems that President al-Bashir is the most famous among all those who are participating. There's a great chance that he gets more than 50%.
The fact that voting was extended, people say this is a reflection on the Election Commission that it did not plan for this because it could have been worse if the other opposition parties had taken part. What do you say to that?
Well, if you take the elections of 2010, polling continued for 5 days. In this election of 2015, we made it only 4 days. So it is less by 1 day. The polling days were less. But in the previous election of 2020, there were 5 days, five consecutive days.
Professor Mokhtar Alassam is chairman of Sudan's National Electoral Commission. He was speaking with VOA's James Batty.
South Sudanese need to forgive the violence, divisions and abuses of the recent past of the young nation if the young nation is to move forward. That is what participants at the public forum agreed to yesterday. They suggested that unless victims of violence are able to forgive their offenders, wounds will never heal and resettlement and revenge will continue. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
Juba-based think tank, the SAD Institute, organized the debate under the theme, Is Forgiveness a Possible Route Towards Reconciliation in South Sudan? Visiting SAD Institute fellow Bernard Oliasua said in his opening remarks that even if a political settlement were reached in Addis Ababa to end the conflict, the country would remain divided. Sua says too many South Sudanese are carrying physical and emotional scars from the past. He says many others have open wounds inflicted on them by their neighbors.
I dare say that even if there was a peaceful political settlement tomorrow, the people of this country must have the audacity and the honesty to confront their past in order to develop a sense of a shared future for the next generation to divide. As a matter of fact, the unresolved grievances means that the people of South Sudan, both young and old, continue to live with the implications of such atrocities daily. Many in our communities are carrying both physical and emotional scars of the past, and many are carrying fresh and open wounds inflicted on them by their immediate neighbors. And the negative effects of such violations manifest on how we interact and relate with others on a daily basis, and they are toxic.
Sua says besides violence, corruption, which many people do not see as a human rights issue, has caused many South Sudanese to suffer. Corruption denies ordinary citizens critical services and amenities such as health, education, good roads and clean water. Sua says the country's leaders must set an example. They must ask for forgiveness for the bad decisions they have made. Those bad decisions have caused millions of South Sudanese to suffer, Sua says.
It would do so much good to this country if the principals were to choose the route to apology to the people of this country, because this war is not their war. And if it was to be done in all sincerity, I believe, it will set an important national milestone for the rest of us to embark on the long process of healing, forgiveness, and reconciliation for the people of this country. In fact, a national sorry day will not be a bad idea either, because it was practiced elsewhere and had tremendous effect.
Deng Dao, a member of the National Assembly and chairperson of War Disabled Commission, agrees with Sua.
If leadership can reconcile and forgive each other, we can definitely get peace in this country. If the communities can forgive each other, and let us have a grassroots mechanism for forgiveness, yes, we can see peace in this country.
General James Hothmai, former chief of staff of the SPLA, says after forgiveness and reconciliation, there has to be justice.
Forgiveness doesn't mean justice. It's not justice. Justice, you have to acknowledge. You have to acknowledge the problems. You have to have punishment, restitutions, apologies. So when you forgive somebody, don't say that justice is already finished. No, it's not. So we have to remember also that we forgive, but the justice has to forgive.
Justice Ajonye Perpetua chairs Central Equatoria States Land Commission. Perpetua agrees with Mai that forgiveness must go hand in hand with justice.
Forgiveness itself is not a weakness, as Desmond Tutu says. It's not a subversion of justice, but it is not also forgetting. And it's also not easy on the side of the victim. Fear may arise that in forgiveness, the evildoers and offenders and perpetrators will remain unpunished. Of course, we cannot punish the whole country. That's why perpetrators, you categorize them in law. Who led? Who is the aider?
More than 200 people attended the forum in Juba. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
A delegation from South Sudan just completed a 5-day visit to Rwanda to mark the 21st anniversary of the start of the genocide in that country. The South Sudanese say they were astonished at how survivors of the Rwandan genocide are able to live side by side with the perpetrators of the mass killings. They say they have come back home with a firm belief that forgiveness must play a central role in rebuilding South Sudan. Grace Abalang is a member of the South Sudan's National parliament. She says she was struck by how Rwandans have been able to work together to help move on from a brutal episode in their history. Abalang says she was particularly moved by one group of Rwandans.
We went to a village in Eastern Province where the perpetrator and the victims are living together reconciled. So we, the people of South Sudan, have to copy the same. We have to say, yes, we have done wrong. We apologize and we forgive each other and we move on.
At least 800,000 people were killed during the Rwandan genocide, in which members of the Hutu majority turned against ethnic Tutsis and moderate Hutus in a 100-day orgy of violence. The genocide was sparked by the death of the then Rwandan president, Juvenal Habyarimana, a Hutu in a plane crash in 1994. Abalang, who hails from Ikotos County in eastern Equatorial State, says she also took note of how far Rwanda has progressed as a model of development. She says South Sudan must develop the same level of cooperation and goodwill as Rwandans did since the violence of 21 years ago.
They have formed the Unity and Reconciliation Commission, which inspired them, plus their church leaders, especially the pastors, who talk to them the importance of being together. So these are the things which really make us to become even emotional when we saw them telling all these stories. Because in some countries, like in our country, it's really very difficult for somebody who came, yes, I've killed your husband, I've killed your children, and apologize.
Reverend Simon Peter Modi, the chairman for National Healing, Peace and Reconciliation Commission in Central Equatorial State, says everyone has to put the nation before their personal or tribal interests.
Not an individual problem, not an issue of the wealth, but to rebuild the nation and then to respect the humanity and to value the humanity. This has been put what is so important and is put forward.
Agostino Kuol Deng, the executive director of South Sudan Youth for Peace and Development Organization, agrees. He says that is exactly why the South Sudanese delegation went to Rwanda.
There are some of the issues of tribe and tribe killing themselves, and it's a political kind of issue, but it will be turned to tribe and tribe killing themselves. So here we can learn the issue of fighting ethnicity, avoiding it, and moving well together.
The South Sudanese delegation's trip was sponsored by the Aegis Trust, an international organization that works to prevent genocide. That report was prepared in Kigali by Mugume Davis Rokaringe.
Juba Teaching Hospital says it gets at least 20 patients a day who are seeking treatment for psychiatric problems. The head of the hospital psychiatrics department says some of the patients are rounded up by health workers and police officers and brought to the hospital for treatment. Jacob Achek has this story from Juba.
Atong Ayuelongar is the head of the psychiatric department and the director of mental health at Juba Teaching Hospital. He said poverty, social and financial problems are common in the patient seeking help.
As any mental ill cases all over the world, we talk about the so-called genetic causes. Those who are having mental illness within their family, they are prone to have mental illnesses. The other thing is with the so-called environmental factors. Mainly we are talking here about trauma and substance of abuse, alcohol and cannabis. Mainly, they are the main causes of presentation here. Plus the trauma of a long-lasting war, plus the crisis of 2013.
Ayel says on normal days, the hospital get around 10 to 15 patients seeking psychiatric help, but she says the number has increased because
we are now having the campaign for the homeless mental health cases, which are moving naked around the cities in the whole country. We start doing this project for Juba City because we are here around. So we go out with the police officer to collect cases in a 3 days duration. We give them medication and we give them clothes and we give them small food items.
The number of homeless people in Juba has increased since South Sudan plunged into conflict in December 2013. Many people flee to Juba, which is safe compared to other parts of country where fighting is still ongoing. But when they arrived, they had nowhere to live. Ayuel says that project to help the homeless will run until July of this year.
Last month, we collect like 38 patients in 2 days, because in the third day we didn't work last month because, you know, of logistic things. So in 2 days we collect like 38 patients. They were all naked. They were all, you know, dirty. But in the second campaign we see this month, this is now the third day. In the previous 2 days we collect like 20 cases.
Ayuel says many of the psychiatric patients that are picked up and brought to the hospital are not able to speak. She said that might be artificially keeping down the number of patients who seek help at the hospital. She says most people with mental problems are given a once-a-month supply of medicine. Many of the patients who are placed on medicine have improved. She says, but the hospital faces another issue as it deals with the psychologically traumatized population in Juba.
Actually, I don't have places to keep them. That's why in my campaign, I go out, I collect them, I give them the so-called long-acting antipsychotic. It's a medicine that stays in their body for 1 month. We give them medication and we advise the family to bring them to a follow-up on a regular basis.
Bashir Emmanuel, 27, is one of the patients who had received help at Juba Hospital. He are separate from mental illness for 2 years.
Bashir Emmanuel, Disabu Shrimsana.
Emmanuel says when he arrived at the hospital, he was told he had to remain there so that he could be given medication. He said when he was discharged last month, he was taken to Gudele. He stayed there ever since. Ayuel said it is very difficult to treat some patients because many does not have a clear diagnosis. She said the mental health department is working to raise community awareness so that relatives of the patient are able to spot the symptom of mental health issues and bring people into hospital quickly for diagnosis and treatment. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudan is mobilizing youth to become peacemakers. That story is coming after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
should men and women share baby care duties equally? Why or why not?
Yeah, they are supposed to share it because the child belongs to both of them. Why not? They have to share it. You know, in South Sudan, it's only for maybe educated class, but for the people in the village, they think taking care of the baby is for the women only. But what we want to tell them that taking care of the baby, even in the village or in the cities or in the towns, is for the both of us.
I think they should. But now I differ on the level of what they are doing. Men and women cannot breastfeed children. Children are breastfed by women. And men also have a role to play in the upbringing of the child by taking care of the needs where they are supposed to do, like providing for finance, for feeding, and their presence too. So I think they should equally, but each with specific duties.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Warabi State is holding a 12-day training for peace builders starting next week. A group of men and women will be brought at the workshop, which will be held at Kwajok. How to gather the views of local communities in reconciliation process in South Sudan. Peter Kod is the communication manager for the National Healing and Reconciliation Committee, which is running the training. He says participants in the workshop will be coming from around counties and payams of Warabi State. Kwad says it is important to involve all communities in South Sudan and get their views and opinions about the best way to heal the country's wounds and move forward.
The training will give skills to these individuals on how to facilitate inter-community dialogue, conflict transformation and conflict resolution. And after the training, they will attend a debrief of 3 days where they will be organized to a group of 4 individuals. Each will go to one payam to hold a payam consultation.
Court says after the information has been collected by the peace builders, it will be analyzed locally and at the county and the state levels. He says the peace mobilizers will interview people from all walks of life.
They will first take 2 to 3 days visiting the bombers, the chiefs, the youth faith-based organizations, and also they will be visiting women representatives and to sell to them the idea and the purpose of the consultations. And then all these groups will be invited to the Payam consultation conference. It will be held at Payam headquarters.
Kwat says the national committee is communicating with the authorities in rebel-controlled areas to try to reach out to the communities there. They have not had a response, he says.
In the rebels-controlled areas, yes, we don't have anything much going on. We wrote several letters to the rebel authorities through their offices in Nairobi. We also went to Addis Ababa last year in May, but we have not been able to get a go-ahead. We are still waiting on their response to be able to provide a safe ground for peace bodies like the committee to go and see the community and talk to the community.
South Sudan's Healing and Reconciliation Committee was established before the country erupted in violence in December 2013. Bishop Daniel Deng Bul of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan has headed the committee since July 2013. Prior to him, former Vice President Riek Machar, who now leads the rebel SPLM in opposition group, held the position.
Jonglei state lawmakers say they want to amend the state's constitution to extend their terms in office and the mandate of the state's caretaker governor. As Philip Thorn Aleu reports from Bor, the lawmakers are seeking to make the changes just weeks after the National Assembly voted to extend the terms of President Salva Kiir, national lawmakers and governors by 3 years.
Jonglei State Assembly Speaker Peter Deng Aguer says lawmakers went to amend two key clauses in the state's constitution.
We had Article 62 illustrating the tenure of the assembly. The other items, which is Article 98, is the tenure of the governor. So it is the same. The tenure is uniform. The assembly tenure and the governor's tenure. So these are the two items going to be amended.
Caretaker Governor John Kung Nguyen was appointed by President Salva Kiir in August 2013 to replace elected governor Kwal Manyang Juk. Manyang is currently serving as defense minister. Caretaker governors are only supposed to remain in office for 2 months before elections are held. Jonglei State Information Minister Judy Jonglei Boyeris says the fact that the current governor of the state is in a caretaker role has no impact on the lawmakers' move to extend his term in office.
We are not extending the position of the caretaker governor. We are extending the position of the office of the governor, not personality.
Aguirre agrees with Boyeris.
The tenor is different and the person is different. So we are now setting the tenor.
Aguirre says the assembly expects caretaker governor Nguyen to introduce an amendment to allow his term and that of state lawmakers to be extended. He says such a bill will be fully supported by the State Assembly. The National Assembly voted last month to extend the terms of all elected officials, including President Kiir, national lawmakers, and state governors by 3 years to July 2018. President Kiir signed the National Term Extension Bill into law last month. Boyeri says once the state constitution has been amended, the terms of Jonglei state lawmakers and the caretaker governor will also be extended to July 2018. Boyeris did not say when the amendment bill will be presented to the state assembly, but he suggested it will occur before May, as any amendment will take 1 month to be debated and voted on. Aguirre dismisses suggestion that Jonglei state lawmakers are trying to mimic national officials as they vote to extend their own terms. To become a law, the amendment must be supported by two-thirds of Jonglei state MPs. Aguirre is confident the bill will be approved and the state's caretaker governor will sign it into law. For VOA News, I am Philip Thonaleo in Bor.
That's all the news we have for the day, but Lucy and Michael, I understand this is your last day here at the Voice of America. Lucy, how long have you been here in America?
This is the 8th month.
And how was it?
It's been nice. It's been fantastic. The only problem was during the winter because I've never been in such a cold weather and it was depressing. But the rest of the time has been good. I've enjoyed my stay here. It's been a pleasure meeting great journalists, people who've been in the business for many years, and working with them has been a learning experience. There's so much that we've learned about the American culture, about the people in D.C. and, well, it's been a learning experience for me.
And Michael, you're also going. I saw you busy packing. How was it for you?
Thanks, John. And it has been a good experience for me, really, for like the first time to come to this world. And as Lucy mentioned, it was my first time to like to see snow and touching snow. You know, we were doing some play game in the snow. So that was the very hard thing that I was like fearing much. Because we are coming from South Sudan, which is 45 to 50 degrees, so you are like in hell. And to other extent, we have been also interacting with so many professionals here in D.C., especially from the Atlas community. Even ourselves as fellows, we are from the different parts of the world, so we meet together and we live together in the same house with them. So you get to know each other, you get to know how people think about certain things and how people like the different perspective and view about the life in general.
And I understand you learned cooking here when you came to the
United
States.
That is one of the most thing that I will admit that one of the things that I learned during my fellowship, also cooking, because back home we depend much on our wives and mothers to cook for us, but here there is no way.
You have to cook for yourself.
You have to do it yourself.
And Lucy, any lessons that you're taking back with you from here?
A lot of lessons. Like Michael said, there's a lot of learning that we did, especially with fellows and people who are here with us at VOA, how the business is run. It was a different experience coming to be where everything is done, looking at how people sit together and make editorial decisions and all these kind of things. These are new things to us, and these are kind of things that we are going to take back home. We're understanding different aspects of the stories, how to tell the story in different ways. And I'd like to thank Atlas for having brought us here and given us the opportunity to share and to learn and to also share what we know about our countries. And it's been a great opportunity.
Yes,
we are going to miss one thing. We're going to miss is this beautiful weather that has just come, the spring and the summer. We're going to miss it, but I know we have plenty of that back.
Yes, Michael, in 30 seconds, what lessons are you taking from here, apart from learning how to cook?
What lesson I'm taking from here is my relation with the world has been extended, like it has been expanded. I'm not no longer looking at only my own community in South Sudan, but I will be able to travel like to any parts of the world. I meet fellows and friends and alumni of Atlas there. That will make the life very easy for me, apart from the professional things that I've learned.
Thank you, Lucy and Michael, for having been with us here for 8 months. And that's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Etoile d'Etat by Congolese music star Koffi Olomide.
Nganga ta formé mona na ye. Atika la toujours na secret moko to mi balé pona ye moko.
We have been listening to Koffi Olomide with the song Etoile d'Etat.
I'm Lucy Pony in Washington.
And I'm also Michael Atit in Washington.
Michael and Lucy, I must thank you for joining me in Studio 17 for the last time. I wish you a safe journey as you embark on your journey back to South Sudan at the end of April. And we would also like to thank our listeners for joining us tonight. Appetit n'a pas eu, Claudia Sassou. Appetit n'a pas eu.